Today's Teisho is on case one in the Pien loop in the Heikigan Roku. Emperor Wu asks Bodhidharma, Engo's introduction, smoke over the hills indicates fire, horns over a fence indicate an ox. Given one corner, you grasp the other three. One glance, you discern the smallest difference. Such quickness, however, is only too common among robed monks. When you have stopped the deluded activity of consciousness, then whatever situation you may find yourself in, you enjoy perfect freedom in adversity and prosperity, in taking and giving. Now tell me, how in fact will this sort of person behave? See Secho's complications. Main subject, Emperor Wu of Liang asks Bodhidharma, what is the first principle of the holy teachings? Bodhidharma said, emptiness, not holiness. Who is this standing before me? Said the emperor. Not knowing, said Bodhidharma. The emperor did not grasp his meaning. Thereupon, Bodhidharma crossed the river and went to the land of Wei. The emperor later spoke of this to Shiko, who said, do you in fact know who this person is? The emperor said, he told me his name was Not Knowing. Shiko said, ah, this is the Bodhisattva Guanyin Kanon, the bearer of the Buddha's heart seal. The emperor was full of regret and wanted to send for Bodhidharma, but Shiko said, it's no good sending a messenger to fetch him back. Even if all the people went, he would not return. Secho's verse, holy teaching, emptiness. What is the secret? Again, who stands before me, not knowing? Inevitable, the thorns and briars springing up. Secretly, by night, he crossed the river. All the people could not bring him back. Now, so many years gone by, still, Bodhidharma fills your mind in vain. Stop thinking of him. A gentle breeze pervades the universe. The master looks around. Is the ancestor there? Yes, bring him to me and he can wash my feet. So I want to thank everybody for doing such a wonderful job this morning with the sitting. We're just beginning to go through this process, this incredible purifying process of Sesshin. And, you know, it's only the first day, but we've already done a lot of sitting. You know, we did three periods last night. We did three periods this morning. And we're on our way. And little by little, we're going to be changed. We're going to be purified. You know? Our awareness has become, you could say, crude. And gradually, we're going to like refine our awareness and become less crude. And as we become less crude, we're going to feel better and better. You know, even if your legs hurt, you're going to feel better and better. It's a process that takes a little time. Many of you have gone through it often, you know, often. But I've been doing this for 40 years, and every time I do this, I begin to feel better. You know, it's like this purifying, liberating process. And, you know, at first it's a little challenging. First couple of days, you know, maybe your legs are already hurting, you know, but But little by little, you know, we come out on the other side of this, very different people. This is the beginning of a collection of koans. It's kind of like a curriculum. Both the Mumonkan and the Pienlu and the Heikigan Roku are like textbooks. These are actually like Zen textbooks. And, you know, both of the textbooks begin in the same way, with emptiness, with mu. And, the textbooks are structured a little differently. You know, the organization of the koans is a little different. And what the koans want us to discover is a little different. You know, they share a number of koans. But they have different styles. You know, Mumon and Engo have different teaching styles, right? And they have a different idea of how to get people from ignorance to awakening. And so they structured these collections in slightly different ways. You know. But they both start with this koan, with emptiness. It's a little different. It's the, does a dog have Buddha nature in the Mumonkan? But here it's the encounter between Dhammo, Daruma, and Emperor Wu, who was a real person. Emperor Wu was a real exemplary person who took over from a very corrupt and destructive person who was leading his country. And Wu had been like a general, and he deposed this murderous and corrupt and very cruel emperor and took over the country and became the emperor. And he was beloved and very effective administrator and very fair, even-handed, honest. In the course of his development as an adult, he became very interested in Chan, in Zen. He became very interested in Buddhism. And he was very pious Buddhist, and he funded the construction of a number of temples and libraries. And we're told that he was so enamored of Buddhism that he would spend like a week at a time up at the temple. He would go up to the temple and put on monk's clothes and be a monk for a week. And his prime ministers and all of his advisors were terrified that he was going to abdicate and become a monk. But he would always come back and run the country. So a very wonderful person who made a huge difference in the lives of his countrymen. You know, he ended a period of terror, a reign of terror, and he put in its place a time of peace and justice and happiness for his people. He was a good-hearted person. So in this koan, he meets Bodhidharma, who was this monk who was bringing Zen to China. And at this time, there wasn't any Zen in China. There were all these other Buddhist schools represented. So in this koan, in this little narrative, Shiko is also a monk. It doesn't tell us that, but Shiko is a monk. And so the emperor is going to interview this very respected meditation master named Bodhidharma, who brings a kind of Buddhism that nobody knew about, Chan or Zen. And when they have their interview, it doesn't go well. Right. Emperor doesn't understand what Bodhidharma is talking about. You know, he thought Bodhidharma was going to talk about compassion, or Bodhidharma was going to talk about karma, or Bodhidharma was going to talk about the Buddha, you know, or Bodhidharma was going to talk about one of the sutras. But he doesn't do any of that. He tries to cut right to the chase, right? Get right to the heart of things. So we get a moment, a snapshot in their interview. Emperor Wu of Liang asked Bodhidharma So you're this very famous meditation master from India, from South India. I understand from other Buddhists that you are quite well regarded. What is it all about? What's it all about? And what Bodhidharma says, the emperor says, what is the first principle of the holy teachings? The holy teachings. We all know what holy is, even if we can't define it, right? The holy is the sacred, the pure, the most special thing, right? The most special, the highest thing. What is the first principle of these holy teachings of the Dharma, of the Buddha? And Bodhidharma says, I'm not interested in holiness or holy teachings. The essence is emptiness. And this is unheard of. The emperor doesn't really understand this at all. And he says, who are you? And Bodhidharma doesn't say, I'm Bodhidharma. I'm from South India, and I'm a great teacher in my homeland. He says, he says, I don't know. Who's standing before me? I don't know. Or he says, I'm not knowing. I'm in a state of not knowing. The emperor did not get his meaning. Thereupon, they don't hit it off. The emperor doesn't say, oh, I get it. They don't get it. He doesn't get it. And so the Bodhidharma leaves the interview and crosses the river and went into the land of Wei. And we know from Zen history that when he went to the land of Wei, he went up into the mountains and lived in a cave where he practiced Chan, where he practiced meditating on emptiness for like 9 years, right? He was sitting in a cave and practicing meditation on emptiness for 9 years, and three students eventually show up, and that's the beginning of Zen in China. After Bodhidharma leaves, because he's not getting anywhere with the emperor spoke to this other Buddhist monk, and there were many Buddhist monks in Liang at this time. As I said, Emperor Wu had built numerous temples and even stayed in them himself. So he turns to one of these monks in his court and he says, who was that person? And the emperor said, he told me he was not knowing. And Shiko said, oh my gosh, I get it. That is the Bodhisattva of compassion, Guanyin, the bearer of the Buddha's heart seal. The emperor is a very good man. He goes, oh my God, what have I just done? Quick, bring him back. And Shiko says, look, he's not going to come back. He's already moved on. He's not going to hold on to this. He lives in a different world, right? Success or failure doesn't bother him. He's already let it go. See? So that's the koan. And so Engo, the anthologist who put together all of these koans in the PNLU, in the Blue Cliff Record or the Blue Rock Collection, thought that this was the most important thing. And just as Mumon thought emptiness, Mu was the most important thing. So, no matter how long we've been practicing Zen, no matter how long we've been practicing, every time we come to Sesshin, we have to return to this, because this is the most important thing, right? And you might think, well, I understand Mu, I know what emptiness is, but it's the door, it's the gate into awakening. And we purify ourselves over and over and over again by walking through that door. When we start sitting, we have all kinds of ideas about what enlightenment might be and who we are and so on and so on. And gradually, the more we meditate, the more we give up on all of those aspirations and all of those images of ourselves. And, you know, this is this can feel at first like a loss or a lack of direction or, you know, it can feel even painful sometimes. But, you know, somehow when we give up on these images of who we are or what we're going to accomplish, you know, we're in a different place. It's really quite wonderful. You know, I had many ideas when I started practicing Zen. You know, I remember when I was in college, I took a course on Buddhism with a man named Jeffrey Hopkins at the University of Virginia, where I was a student. And Hopkins was really a Tibetan Buddhist, and the course was very scholastic, and we had to study lots of concepts. But I remember talking to a friend of mine who was also in the course, a guy named Tom. And we got together like once a week, and we would do what we thought was meditation, just a little bit of meditation. We would sit for like 15 minutes or something. And I remember telling Tom that I was pretty sure that if I really applied myself, you know, if I really applied myself, I could probably achieve enlightenment in a week or something like that. I remember saying something like that. And when I actually ran into a Zen teacher, Genki Roshi, in Seattle, you know, I still had this idea that, you know, I was going to become an enlightened person, you know. And I had this fantasy that you know, Zen training would be something like this. You know, I would go into Dokusan and Genki Roshi would tell me something like almost like a magical technique, right? Where Genki Roshi would say something to me and I would take it back to the cushion and, you know, be transformed. And instead he told me to watch my breath, right? This is a first koan in Zen. You know, usually the teacher will ask you to watch your breath. And I remember being so dejected because I thought Genki Roshi was going to give me the secret teachings. He was going to say, look, you know, do this, this, and this, and I would do it, and it would be like an acid trip, right? Suddenly everything would be different, everything would be glowing, or I would dissolve into this flow or something. And instead he said, watch your breath. And I felt almost insulted. I didn't feel angry, but I felt like, why is he not sharing the secrets with me, you know? And so I went back to my cushion and I would just watch my breath. And mostly I was thinking, and I would come in to see Genki Roshi and he would say, how's it going with your breath? And I would say, oh, you know, and I usually had a little poem or, I kept feeling that I had to come up with some insight. I had to say something to Genki that would show him that I was a special person or that I had gotten some kind of special insight. So, you know, I wrote poems and I would come in and say, you know, I just crazy stuff, right? You know, that, and he would just ring his bell and I would go out. And then, you know, it took me the longest time to focus on the breath. You know, when I would sit down on the cushion, I would do a lot of thinking, even, or I would be sort of in a dreamy state. So thoughts, images, and so on and so on. And it was very hard for me to get to the breath proper, you know, to actually be with the breath. And then, you know, one day, quite unexpectedly, you know, my mind just went blank. I can remember when it happened. I was staying with some friends at their house. They were away, and I was staying in their house. And their house was really cold. They had this big house. And they wanted me to take care of it while they were away. And they kept the heat so It was just like unbearably cold to save money. And I would go into one of their bedrooms and just meditate. And so it was very cold. And we were staying in the kitchen. Barbara and I were staying in their kitchen to stay warm. And we had like a little space heater in there. And I went away and I sat in this room. And everything just disappeared. Right? It was just like everything disappeared. And I had never experienced anything like that before. And I had no idea what it meant, right? And then, you know, later I was back in Dokusan with Genki Roshi. You know, I never realized how important, I so wish that I had gone in to see him in Dokusan and said, Genki Roshi, you know, the strangest thing was happening. I was meditating on my breath and everything disappeared. It was like I fell into a dark hole. And I didn't do that because I didn't think it had anything to do with the breath, you know. But that was, I remember that experience even now, because it was one of those things where you wonder, how long was I, where was I, and how long was I in that place? But I never connected it with the breath. And I went back to doing Dokusan with Genki Roshi, and I continued not to pass my koan. And it was only, you know, years later that I realized what had happened to me, you know. I thought I understood the breath, you know. The breath goes in, and one of the answers I would give Genki Roshi was the breath goes in and the breath goes out. The breath goes in and the breath goes, and he would just ring the bells like, you haven't a clue, you haven't a clue. And that's not how it works at all. You know, that's what we think is the breath, right? We think is the breath. But that's not the breath. That's our idea of the breath. So what happened to me in that freezing cold house when we were taking care of my friend's giant empty freezing house was that I was watching the breath. And as I was watching the breath, everything disappeared. See? And those two things weren't separate as I thought they were. They really go together. You know, I later realized that they go together, but it took me a long time in my practice to see how they fit together. You know, years later, like 15 years later, I had a chance to study with another Zen teacher, not Genki Roshi, but his name was Eido Roshi, Eido Shimano Roshi. And when I was studying with him, one day he said, listen, try this. We were practicing in his temple in the Catskills, and it was on a lake, a place, Beecher Lake. And the bird life was astonishing. You know, it was just like in the afternoon, there were so many birds. It was just like a cacophony of bird sounds. And Eido Roshi said, pick out a sound that's repetitive and just listen to it. And so I went back to my cushion in the Zen hall, and I listened and listened and listened, and I heard like this bird, and it was just like this recurrent, you know, note. It was like tweet, tweet. It wasn't a tweet, but it was like, and it went on and on. And I listened to that sound, and all of a sudden, it was like I fell off a cliff. It was just like, it was a sensation of like falling off a cliff. And when I fell off the cliff, it's like everything disappeared. Everything disappeared. So it wasn't like the first time where I felt like everything went black, right? But it was like falling off a cliff. I had the falling sensation. And I was falling, 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 and there was just nothing. And then I was in this extraordinary calm place. And when I went in to see the Roshi, I said, you know, my nose is in front of my face and my ears are on the side of my head. You know, that was my answer. And you know, it was like everything was different now. Everything was different. See. So I hadn't understood this. It took me like 15 years to figure this out because I'm a slow learner. But you know, when we start doing meditation, we watch the breath. And sometimes when we watch the breath, we get to a place where our mind becomes empty. Our mind becomes empty. So you're watching the breath and there's all these thoughts. And you keep watching the breath and you're fighting to get to the breath. And finally, you know, it's like the thoughts are here and the breath is over here, and there's a shift, and the thoughts are here and the breath is here. And now you're watching the breath. This is called one-pointed attention. But when you achieve one-pointed attention, you know, the damnedest thing happens. Because you're achieved one-pointed attention, but when you achieve one-pointed attention, all of a sudden the object of your attention disappears. And you're in mushin, what we call mushin, you're in emptiness. And then the damnedest thing happens. You know, if you get into mushin, you can't stay in mushin. You come out of mushin again. And you can't stay there no matter how good a meditator you are, no matter how, if you were the Buddha, you couldn't stay there, right? So we're watching the breath, or we're listening to a bird. And when we achieve one-pointed attention with the object of our attention, everything disappears, see? And everything disappears, and then everything comes back, see? So this is all very strange. This is not how we normally experience reality, right? You know, or it's not our image of reality, But actually it is reality. It is reality. You know, we have an image of reality that's very false, very confused and mistaken. It's like half of a picture. It's like half of a picture, half of reality. It's like if you have an injury that costs you an eye, you know, or let's say you're born without two eyes, you're born with one eye. See, you never know what depth is, right? You never do, because depth is caused by like the stereoscopic aspect of our eyes, right? You actually have two eyes giving your brain information. It's like two different angles, and it creates the impression of depth, right? If you unfortunately didn't have sight in both of your eyes, you would never know what depth is. You'd be going through your whole, yes, you can test it out. but it's true. People who have eye injuries, they're not allowed to drive cars because they don't have depth perception, really. So look, you'd never know what depth is, right? It's like that. You know, we're like people with one eye. We see half of reality. You know, we see reality, but we don't see the depth dimension of reality, right? It's like having one eye. And if you have two eyes, you know, you'd never guess. If you had an eye injury, you know, at birth, and suddenly at 10 years old, they restored your sight, you'd suddenly say, oh my gosh, you know, people who have one eye, you know, often they have a very hard time distinguishing depth. So going downstairs is a big challenge for them if they're not very careful, because it's all a flat surface to them, see? So this is how, you know, we have some problems with our ordinary consciousness. It gives us a distorted view of reality because it excludes the dimension of depth, or half of what's really going on at any particular moment. When you restore that missing half, everything is different, just like having two eyes would completely transform the way you experience the world. We have a distorted view, and we construct an image of reality that's like, in the sutras, it's called an upside down view, upside down, inverted reality. But it's really not, it doesn't quite capture it, right? It's as though we only see half of everything that happens. It's a flat or dimensionless reality. And when we add back the other dimension, everything has a different character. See, rather than call it an upside down view, I'd like to call it, like, what happens to us is that we get trapped in like foreground thinking, and we don't see the background, right? And the background is the way everything is connected. So look, I don't know if you've ever had a chance to see Javanese and Chinese, actually, like Cantonese, there's shadow puppets in South China, Cantonese shadow puppets, and Javanese, Indonesian, Balinese shadow puppets. But they're wonderful. If you can Google after Sesshin, you can investigate shadow puppets. But what it is there's a screen, and there's a light source behind the screen. And the screen is usually like golden or silver. It used to be like a very thin piece of paper, right? Very thin piece of rice paper, right? But very thin, and sometimes maybe waxed, right? So it's almost transparent. And there's a light source behind the screen, and then there are puppeteers, and they bring the puppets to the front of the screen, to the back of the screen. So the audience is sitting on the other side of the screen, and they see a luminous screen because the light source is projecting through the screen, and it's just a luminous field. It's like a big light square, golden square or luminous square. And then the puppeteers come in, and the puppets are just flat cutouts, you know, and they're on little sticks. And often in Southeast Asia, they're characters from the Ramayana, the great Indian national epic. So it's like Rama and Sita and so on, and Ravana, you know. So all of these characters are moving around, and so it's a show, right? This is like a puppeteer, Japanese shadow puppets. Okay. So we live in a world which is like the Javanese shadow puppets. I'm convinced that this must have been invented by a Buddhist, but you know, because it's so close, right, to what we believe, even though we don't know we believe this. You know, we look at the puppets, and all we see is the puppets. Now, we don't see the luminous screen, right? And because we're so absorbed in the puppets that we don't see the screen, we only get half the picture. So you know, we live in a world of like pieces. Everything's in little pieces, and the connections are not obvious because the connection isn't on the level of the little piece. The connection is the luminous ground, and at the front, are the little puppets moving. See? So our world looks fragmented and frightening, and unstable, and so on and so on, right? It's engaging. It's like a puppet show, right? It's engaging. It gets our attention, but it's only half the picture. And it's a distorted view, because what we're seeing is real, but it's only like pieces of something much bigger. You know, they have done studies, psychologists have done studies where they give a picture, they'll show a picture, and it's basically a black page, and at the center of the black page, there's a white circle. See? And they'll ask Western people in the West, what is this? And they'll say, it's a white circle. And they'll ask people from East Asia, what is this? And they'll say, it's a wall with a hole in it. Isn't that interesting? So, you know, Western people focus on the foreground, and the Asian people focus on the whole thing. So it's not, we say, oh, it's a white circle. And the eye of people in East Asia is trying to look at the whole thing, and they say, oh, it's a hole in a wall. Well, they'll say it's a moon gate or something like that. So, you know, the thing that holds all this together, we don't see, you know. And people in East Asia don't see it either, even in spite of their cultural training, right? But what we're doing when we encounter emptiness is we're putting everything in the foreground against the background. The emptiness is the background, and what we call form is the foreground. And so this is why it feels so good to encounter emptiness, right? It's like we're only getting half the picture because we don't see the connecting principle. It would be like my time talking, but only him every other word, right? That's like they were getting information like that, right? We're not getting the whole thing. We're getting every other word, right? So this business of emptiness is really important. You know, when we sit down on the cushion and we experience the sound of a bird, tweet, 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 it feels continuous. It feels continuous. And we create a mental image of what's happening, but it's false. It's half true, half true. Our senses are too crude, are too crude. So when we sit down on the cushion and we meditate and we begin to listen to the sound of the bird, or we watch the breath, or it could be a candle, you know, whatever is the object of your attention, you focus on this, and all of a sudden, you know, at some point, the object of your attention will disappear. It might just be like a finger snap. It will disappear, and then suddenly there's nothing. We say nothing. That's how it appears to us at first. And then, you know, it comes back, right? It's like something, nothing, something, nothing, something, nothing, something, nothing. And for a long time, this makes no sense, right? But for some reason, when we do this, we feel better. We feel calmer and more trusting and more whole. You know, how can emptiness make you feel more whole? You know, how is that possible, right? Well, emptiness makes you feel more whole because it brings the two whole parts together, right? It's a both parts now. It's like there's a very famous Chinese Zen poem called the Poem of the Matching Halves. And it's like two coins, right? You know, one coin, and they're broken in two and they're lost, right? And they're circulating around. And one person meets another person and they hold up their pieces of coin and they put them together, and the coin is now, it fits. It's like now we've got the whole coin. So, you know, this darkness and this nothingness, so-called, and this somethingness are not opposites or enemies. They go together. And what we call something is the foreground, and what we call nothing is the background, is the ground, right? That you could say the background, foreground and background, or figure and background. And so because we only see half the picture, we live in a world of fragments. And it's very terrifying for that reason, right? It's frightening, it's disturbing, and it doesn't have to be cataclysmic. It's just unnerving because we always feel like things are moving in a totally random way or an unpredictable way. And we always feel at sea. It's sort of like that, but we have a kind of baseline anxiety because this is how we experience the world. But when we restore the missing dimension, right, we see there's a kind of this wholeness to things. Engo says at the beginning. He says, look, when you see smoke coming up over behind a mountain, you know, uh-oh, there's fire. When you see smoke coming up, you know there's fire. See, if you see two horns across behind a hedge, you think, look out, it's an ox, right? You know, if you're given one corner of a square, somebody just shows you a picture of one corner, you grasp the other three, see? And he says, but, you know, that kind of intelligence, that kind of quickness, everybody has, see? So if you see two horns, you don't have to see the whole ox. If you see smoke, you don't have to see the whole, you don't have to see the forest going up in flames. If you see one corner of a parallelogram, you know what's there, right? But that's just in the realm of form. That's just the realm of form. The realm of form is just part of something else. The form and the formless go together. They go together. And they go together maybe like two pieces of one coin, but I think they go together like foreground and background, that the foreground is what we call form and the background is what we call emptiness. So the background fills in the spaces, see, if that makes any sense. So he says, when you have stopped the diluted activity of consciousness, consciousness just focuses on the foreground. It just focuses on form. When you have stopped just putting things together in that way, you achieve a kind of wholeness, right? Wholeness. And then you enjoy perfect freedom in adversity and prosperity, in taking and giving. Okay. So this is what Emperor Wu of Liang was unprepared to absorb, right? Emperor Wu of Liang was like somebody who had one eye, and Bodhidharma comes in and says, let's talk about depth perception. And what Emperor Wu of Liang goes, depth perception, I see a chair, I see a bed, I see a table, but I have no idea what you're talking about, right? And so Daruma says, it's all about the connecting principle is emptiness. Emptiness is the connecting principle. There's this impression, this sensation, this thought, and they seem disjointed, but they're all connected. But what connects them, you can't see with your discriminating mind. See? And when you put them together, now, this is why at the end of a session, everything feels so alive. Everything seems so fresh. Problems that seem insurmountable are solved, right? And we can start a session feeling totally beaten down and totally lost. And at the end, we end up feeling this tremendous energy and joy. And somebody might say, well, what have you learned? And say, I don't know. I haven't learned anything. I don't know anything more than when I came here, see? But what we know is the emptiness part. It's like, now I see how all of this fits together, right? I'm not looking at just the foreground, the whole, I'm looking at the wall. So important. Emptiness is the connecting principle. Emptiness is the ground, right? And the character of emptiness will change as we continue in our practice. At first, it seems dark and blank, but as our senses are refined, our Dharma eye is purified, the character of what we see will change. I promise you. Emperor Wu of Liang asked Bodhidharma, what is the first principle of the holy teachings? Bodhidharma said, emptiness, not holiness. Who is standing before me? Not knowing, said Bodhidharma. The emperor did not grasp his meaning. Thereupon, Bodhidharma crossed the river and went to the land of Wei. The emperor later spoke of this to Shiko, who said, do you know who this person is? Do you know who you just talked to? And the emperor says, well, he told me his name was not knowing. Shiko said, that was the Bodhisattva Kanon, the Bodhisattva of compassion, the bearer of the Buddha's heart seal. The emperor was full of regret and wanted to send for Bodhidharma, but Shiko said, it's no good sending a messenger to fetch him back. Even if all the people went after him, he would never return. The holy teaching, emptiness. What is the secret here? Again, who stands before me? Not knowing. Not knowing. So we're returning to the ground. We're returning to the field from which everything arises. And we will do that by entering deep wuxing.